Minnesota Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order and let the record show that we have a quorum present. Before we begin, I had a few comments that I wanted to give to our members. Some of you have looked at the schedule for Senate Judiciary, and it reveals like 3 hours on the schedule, on a weekly schedule, 2 days at an hour and a half. And anyone who's worked with the Judiciary Committee or is familiar with it know, and Senator Scheid's smirking at this, we can't get our work done in 3 hours a week. We have huge, huge areas to cover in civil law, criminal law, and in dealing with the court system. And so I spoke briefly with Senator Latz and Senator Harrington even this morning, saying that if anyone thinks that you're here just for 3 hours a week, you have another thing coming. The other difficulty we have is we have three committees doing the work of our one committee in the House. They have roughly a little under 15 hours of meeting time in the House. And although most senators can easily do the work of two state representatives, we probably need a little bit more in proportion of time than just the 50% split. We probably, as we get closer to bills and deciding on bills, we will be needing more time, and the chair will certainly extend hours during the day as much as we can. We have an hour before this committee meets in this room and a half an hour after, so we could grab 3 hours a day if needed, and we also have evenings. And dare I say, we have Fridays, and if we had to, well, there's other days in the week. But nevertheless, I don't want to go into our weekends. So, if we can keep all of our comments as we wrestle with issues, if we can keep that in mind, we can avoid the late nights, we can avoid the weekends, and but if the committee wants to discuss things to a greater degree, we can oblige them of that too. Just wanted to make everyone be made aware of that. Anyone that's been on a Judiciary Committee certainly is aware of the sometimes the difficulty of creating law in the Judiciary Committee. Nevertheless, if anyone has any questions at this time, you could ask them. If not, we can get into our testimony. Senator Latz? Nobody?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Latz.
I would just say I appreciate the need to do the work of the committee. For those of us who have families, I'll suggest that evenings are a bit of a challenge as well, and I would encourage members to try to focus succinctly on the issues before the committee so we can try to avoid that, at least in the earlier portion of the session. I think we all realize we sometimes get stuck here later toward the end of session.
That's a good point, Senator Latz. And also for our rural members or members outside of the metropolitan area, if we have to meet on Fridays, I'm going to try and schedule a room for as early on Fridays as possible, giving everyone at least a chance to get back to their constituents and their families over the weekend as well. Other than that, we're going to start with Mr. Chris Turner. He's our fiscal analyst, and he wanted to give us a little bit of a perspective on our committee accounts. So where do we spend money? And what has been a kind of a snapshot? We need to have a snapshot of these committees and get our members more familiar with the scope of where we are. So, Mr. Turner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and members, I'll be referring to the committee jurisdiction summary spreadsheet that should be in your packets. So if you take that out, we can quickly go over this. The way the spreadsheet is set out, we have the agency being funded. The first column is the 2008-2009 actual spending. Next column is our current budget, 2010 and 11. And the next column is the base budget. So you have 6 years of compare, three bienniums. The next column is the change from the 08-09 biennium to 2012-13 base. And then that's the numerical change. Then the next column is the percentage change from 08-09 to 12-13. And finally, we have the percentage of the public safety budget that that department or division or court is. So I will I'll quickly go over this. As you can see, for 2012 and 13, we have a general fund based budget of $1,782,650,000. This funds 19 general fund departments, divisions, courts, and boards. And we also have jurisdiction over three special revenue accounts, two Department of Public Safety divisions, and the Peace Officer Standards and Training Board. And they're listed on the back of the sheet. Quickly going down, we've got the Supreme Court, which is divided into two entities, the Supreme Court Operations and Civil Legal Services. Then we have a total Supreme Court line. Total for the Supreme Court in our base is $84,360,000. We will be hearing from them shortly. We'll also be hearing from the Appeals Court today, the next line down. Their funding has been looks like it's flat, although we did create a new three judge panel back in 08-09, which isn't indicated here. Finally, the district courts, $464,400,000, one of the largest jurisdictions in our budget, comprises 26% of our budget. We'll be hearing from the three of them today, plus the Board of Public Defense, which if you jump down is funded at $129,452,000, or 7.3% of our budget. Between those, we have some smaller entities. The Guardian Ad Litem Board, which was just created last year. It used to be under the administration of the district courts. And we have the Tax Court, Uniform Laws Commission, Board on Judicial Standards. Then we have two of our other very large accounts, the Department of Public Safety, and we have six divisions of the nine divisions that make up the Department of Public Safety. We have Homeland Security and Emergency Management, Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, Gambling and Alcohol Enforcement, and the Office of Justice Programs. Those are the six general fund divisions. Department of Public Safety total base spending is $156,530,000, or 8.8% of our budget. Then listed, going down the list, we have a small agency, or small board, the Private Detective Board, the Department of Human Rights, and then our largest account, the Department of Corrections, which makes up 50% of our total budget. It's divided into three divisions: the Institutions Division, which funds the prisons; Community Services, which is mainly passed through money to the various community corrections and probation agencies; and then Operations Support, which is the administrative arm of the department. Finally, we have the Sentencing Guidelines, and then we have the general fund total at the bottom. I've got a notes section here. I don't want to go into too much detail because we don't want to take any time away from the courts. The one major note I would make here is the 2010 American Recovery Act for the institutions. It was $38 million in federal money in 2010. That was not reflected in the base for 2012 and 13, and that's something that we will be addressing when the department comes before us. On the back is quickly listed our three special revenue accounts: the direct appropriations, the post board, peace officer standard and training, which is funded from the criminal traffic surcharge; the fire marshal, who is with the Department of Public Safety, funded from the fire safety account, which is composed of a 0.065 fire insurance surcharge; and then the Department of Public Safety radio system, which is funded by the 911 account on each telephone line, which is currently at 80 cents per line. The overviews will go into more detailed budget activity. Each one of these departments, divisions, and boards can be broken down into quite some detail, and any questions you may have, I'm here to assist you in further breaking it down and analyzing the budget. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll turn it back to you.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And getting to the guardian ad litem, new budget that we put together last year, is that reflected in the district courts as a reduction there then? Obviously it must be.
Mr.
Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, yeah, that was backed out of, when we created the board, 2011 is the first fiscal year that they're funded at $12,367,000. That was backed out of the district courts last year.
Right.
So if you can see, the district courts are at $464,000 for their 12 and 13 base. The equivalent number would be if you add the $24,000 to the $464,000, or that's million, excuse me, and then compare that to the 08-09 spending, which would include the guardian ad litem.
Right. Thank you.
Any other questions for Ms. Turner?
Yes.
Senator Harrington.
Two quick questions. One, where would Minnesota Highway Patrol fit under the Department of Public Safety budget? And the second question is, given what we already can project about the flooding for next year, is the $3.7 million a reasonable number to project for a base?
Mr. Turner.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Harrington, two very good questions. The State Patrol is one of the nine divisions of the Department of Public Safety. Oddly enough, we don't have it. The Department of Transportation has it in their budget. Okay. And then number two, Homeland Security, that is a very misleading number historically, because we've set up a base budget of $3,700,000 for disaster assistance. It has always been way too low. It used to be higher, but as we've cut the budgets over the last decade, that's been an easy place to gather general fund money now and then appropriate in a special session the money needed later. So we pared that down to $3.7 million for the biennium. It has never been that low. And if you look back, say in the 2008, we spent $13 million, and that's almost all disaster assistance. Next year, biennium, this current one, $30 million already, and that would include the special session in August where we spent $15.8 million in that one bill alone.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Harrington. We have an agenda that will be including the courts again today, as well as the Public Defense Board. Chief Justice Gilday is going to open the comments up today. We went a little long on our question and answer with Mr. Turner, but we'll be watching the clock. Chief Justice, thanks for coming again. And I know that we'll be getting into a little more detail than what we had 2 days ago.
Yes. Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Lapp.
As the Chief Justice prepares to make remarks, I thought it'd be appropriate to read one very brief comment here. It's become instructional around the country to refer back to the founding documents, in this case the Constitution for the state of Minnesota, when framing our discussions in the legislature. And I thought I'd highlight Minnesota Constitution Article 1, Section 8, which refers specifically to our jurisdiction. Every person is entitled to obtain justice freely and without purchase, completely and without denial, promptly and without delay, conformable to the laws. So I hope that will help frame our analysis as we hear from the Chief Justice.
Thank you, Senator Latz. You'll probably find that Chief Justice Gilday has that very same section of Minnesota Constitution in her comments as well. So, Chief Justice Gilday, thank you for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. For the record, I'm Lori Gilday, Chief Justice of the Minnesota Supreme Court and the administrative head of the judicial branch of our state government. I am told that this is the first time, at least in modern memory, that the Chief Justice has testified before a legislative committee on the judicial branch budget. Judges are creatures of precedent, and we do not lightly depart from precedent. I depart from precedent today, however, because of the urgency of the question before you. The Minnesota justice system is at the breaking point. I come before you today to urge the legislature to stop the further dismantling of this core function of our government. I come to you today to talk about the right all of our citizens have, the right to simple justice. In 1862, Lafayette Emmett, Minnesota's first Chief Justice, wrote these words, quote, "All must regard as a matter of pride and gratulation that in this state, no one, not even the worst felon, can be denied the right to simple justice. In this state, no one can be denied the right to simple justice. We are here today to ask the members of this committee to ensure that this inspiring and confident command remains reality in Minnesota. The courts are a branch of government. We are not a state agency. We are vital to the government's basic function, protecting public safety, ensuring individual rights, and providing a forum for the orderly and civil resolution of disputes. And yet, the judicial branch accounts for less than 2% of our state's general fund. Further cuts to the judicial branch budget can do little to solve the large deficit problem that our state faces. But I can guarantee you that further cuts to the justice system will have very real and visible consequences in our communities. We have a system that is already so strained that the Minnesota Court of Appeals has recently dismissed criminal convictions in 3 felony cases due to the failure of the district courts and the state to meet speedy trial demands. Members, the most recent dismissal came on Tuesday, this Tuesday, when the Coalition to Preserve Minnesota's Justice System was here speaking with you. Our coalition partners on Tuesday and my judicial colleagues today urge the legislature not to further jeopardize this basic core function of our government. We urge you to act to assure a functioning justice system, the system that our citizens expect, the system that our citizens deserve, and the system that our Constitution commands. To begin our budget presentation, I have asked Sue Dosal, our state court administrator, to provide an overview of the judicial branch and our FY12-13 budget request. She will be followed by Chief Judge Ed Lynch and Judge Tom Neville to talk about the impact of cuts we have already taken on the trial courts. Then Chief Judge Matt Johnson of the Court of Appeals will do the same for his court. I will close with a few words about the Supreme Court and our branch-wide request.
Thank you, Chief Gilday. Ms. Dosal, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman and members, for the record, my name is Sue Dosal. I'm the State Court Administrator. And my role this afternoon is to provide a very brief overview of the judicial branch, its mission, its structure, workload, a little budget history, and talking about how we've taken past budget cuts and are trying to prepare for budget challenges ahead, and finally to present the FY12-13 judicial branch budget request. I'm going to be working off the PowerPoint slides that are in your packet, and if you turn to the slide 2, center lats are ready.
Good slide.
Ms. Dosal, is this the...
Yes. And this... Okay. And you can see the slides are numbered on right. Each of those. So slide
Please
2
proceed.
Is indeed the excerpt from Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. which really does command that all cases, not just criminal cases that we think about, but all cases, criminal and civil, be handled promptly and without delay, obviously because justice delayed is justice denied. On slide three, to carry out the constitutional mission of the judicial branch, we have 315 judges, about 2,500 employees, handling 1.7 million cases in 99 locations with an annual budget of about $285 million. Of that $285 million annual budget, as Mr. Turner indicated, it funds both the trial courts, the appellate courts, and the state court administration, the state law library, and civil legal services. Of the $285 million, about $273 million is for the courts, about $11.8 million for civil legal services, and that's a program that we'll be presenting to you separately at another day. But I think it's important to recognize that of the while the courts have a $273 million budget, as you can see on this slide, the courts collect about $200 million every single year, which is sent to the counties, to municipalities, and to the state government. None of this is retained by the courts. On slide four, this is the organizational structure of the courts. We have a streamlined three-tier system, two appellate courts, and a single trial court known as the district court. Slide five is a map. Our district courts operate in all 87 counties, but for administrative purposes, we are organized into 10 judicial districts, which also are the election districts for our judges. On slide six, our district courts have 289 judges, and this is where most of the nearly 1.7 million cases that we have are filed. Slide seven is the Court of Appeals with 19 judges who sit in three-judge panels across the state. The court hears appeals from the trial courts, the Commissioner of Economic Security, and administrative agency decisions. Slide eight, of course, is the Supreme Court, the highest court of our state, with seven justices. It hears appeals from the Court of Appeals, also from two executive branch courts, the Tax Court and the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals, and has original jurisdiction in first-degree murder convictions, legislative election contests, judicial and attorney discipline. And the Supreme Court also has the responsibility for regulating the practice of law. Turning now to our budget on slide nine, this is to really try to put our situation in some context. The judicial branch really has been underfunded for a number of years, with base budget cuts coming in each of the last 3 years. In FY09, our base was cut by $4 million. For this current biennium, we took a cut in the 2009 session of $5 million, and then again last year, an additional $9.6 million. So for a total of about $14.6 million for the biennium. In addition, we've had to absorb $2.3 million in unavoidable personnel costs. These are increased costs for health insurance for employees that are negotiated by MMB, and increased costs for that were statutorily mandated for the employer contribution to employee pensions. So these are costs over which we have no control. We had to pay and obviously had to cut other things to do that. So this has had about a $17 million impact on our budget. Also, last year, the legislature authorized an additional 1% cut, or about $646,000, to the Supreme Court base budget going into this FY12-13 biennium. Slide 10 begins talking about the impacts of that. Because of this past underfunding and the recent budget cuts, we're now operating about 10% short-staffed. Since FY08, we have abolished or holding open 250 positions across the state. We have cut these positions by implementing a voluntary separation program, a voluntary leave without pay, hiring freeze, and layoffs, and we have also implemented a total pay freeze for all employees and all of our judges for the past 2 years. Next slide. Despite needing 20 additional judges to do the work that we have to help close this budget gap, we are now holding open every judicial vacancy for at least 4 months, and we've had to cut retired judge use, further exacerbating the judge shortage that we have. And we've also taken cuts to drug courts, to our mandated services and operating budgets, and we have closed public counters half a day a week in more than half of our judicial districts. As a result, because of these staff shortages and judge shortages, backlogs and delays are building around the state, and you're going to hear more about that from presenters in just a few minutes. Turning to slide 12, as the Chief Justice mentioned on Tuesday, in the context of these budget cuts and the significant budget challenges ahead, that we have been really on a fast track to find efficiencies and to expand the use of technology to reduce costs, and we've been doing that by reengineering how we deliver services. I really don't have time in the limited period we have to talk about all of these, but clearly our most ambitious is the centralizing of our payable citations. Of the 1.7 million cases we handle, about 1 million are payable citations, and we are totally redesigning how we are processing those. We are moving from the processing of these payable citations from the 87 counties to a centralized virtual payment center with fewer and lower paid staff handling these cases. We also have any overdue debt automatically referred to the Department of Revenue, which is our collections vendor. You can now pay these citations online by phone or by mail. So this initiative is cutting costs, is improving customer service, and it is increasing the revenue coming back to state and local government. It's also been the catalyst for increased implementation of e-citations from law enforcement and e-charging from prosecutors across the state. And it really is a very big step toward our future vision of an all-electronic record. And all of that is with the objective of reducing future labor costs. Well, this slide shows the laundry list of some of the other initiatives we have underway, and I'd be happy to talk about those, but again, in view of the limited time, you know, the point that we want to make here and make clear to you is that the judicial branch is absolutely committed to being good stewards of the scarce taxpayer dollars that we are given, and that we are working as hard and as fast as we can to implement these changes in order to deal with the very real budget challenges I know that you face and we all face as a state ahead. So finally, the last slide here is what our budget request is. Recognizing the historic budget challenges facing the state of Minnesota, the judicial branch is requesting what is essentially a hold harmless budget. We are asking only for funding beyond our current base budget for, again, these unavoidable personnel costs. These are the increased health insurance costs for employees, which is projected now by MMB, and for the statutorily mandated increase in pension costs. This accounts for about $6,750,000 branch-wide, as indicated in this chart. As you've heard on Tuesday and again here, and you'll hear more about, the justice system is fraying at the seams, and the judicial branch is requesting only that which would prevent further erosion in our ability to carry out the constitutional mission of the judicial branch. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would either stand for questions or, if in view of the time, you'd like to hold those and we can answer them at the end.
Thank you. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Dozel, slide 10, if you please. You indicated there was a pay freeze for fiscal year 10 and 11, and you specifically mentioned judges. My question is, was that a pay freeze for all employees of the judicial branch or just judges? And the follow-up question is, in your requested budget, is there similarly a pay freeze for fiscal year 12 and 13?
Mr. Chairman and Senator
Newman.
Yes, thank you. The pay freeze for this current biennium is total, all employees and all judges. No pay raises. And the request that we have for 12-13 includes no increased funding for projected pay increases for anyone. The judicial branch has three unions with which we must collectively bargain. So all I can say to you is that we're not requesting any new funding for pay increases.
Thank you.
Ms. Dosell. Are the unions requesting a pay increase?
Mr. Chairman, we do not open negotiations with the unions until this coming spring, so we have been talking to them clearly about the historic budget problems that we all face, and they know what our budget request is.
And Ms. Dosell, the one question I had is, as a result of going to your hold harmless budget request on page 13, slide 13, we heard that there's been recently three felony dismissals due to the fact that defendants are requesting a speedy trial. Now, that's with pretty much an existing budget as it is. Your suggestion to hold harmless a budget request, should we expect other felony dismissals if we're not increasing the base load for the courts?
Well, Mr. Chair and members, as we presented on Tuesday, the justice system is an ecosystem, and there are many parts to the system that are involved in each of these cases. We recognize the historic deficit of the state, and we will try to do everything we can on the court's part. We're trying to re-engineer how we do these do our operations and to become more efficient so that we can at least prevent, you know, even any further damage to the justice system on our part. Clearly, the other parts of the justice system also, need assistance. So I'm not sure if the chief would like to expand on that, but we're just trying to do our part to be part of the solution here that you all face. Yeah,
well, we greatly appreciate that, Ms. Dosell. I think we're going to continue with our agenda, and then we'll have time to ask questions later. Let's see. The next person would be Judge Edward Lynch, 1st Judicial District. Welcome, Judge.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it is a pleasure for me to be here. And you can recognize the strain on the trial courts because Judge Neville is to be here as well, but he has not showed up yet. It is also a pleasure for me to be here because it gives me a break from the sixth day of a divorce trial that I'm trying that I have to go back to as soon as I get done testifying. My name is Ed Lynch. I'm a judge in the 1st Judicial District. I'm chambered in Dakota County. I know that this is a challenging session for everyone in the room. For you, because you have to allocate scarce resources to meritorious requests, and for everyone else, because we have to live with what you do. I understand and expect that the focus of this session will be on priorities, and that those priorities will be based upon the need for and the value of the services provided to the people of Minnesota. I'm here today to suggest to you that funding for the judicial branch should be one of those priorities. For three reasons, really. We provide a constitutionally mandated core government service. We have been responsible stewards of the resources you've provided in the past. And quite frankly, we've done a good job. Let me talk about the core services. I think many people, when they think of courts, they think of traffic tickets and criminal prosecutions. And that certainly is an important part of the core services that we provide. But let me give you three examples that will kind of give you a feel for the other types of services we provide. A preteen girl who was involved in a child protection proceeding because of emotional and physical abuse by her mother wrote a letter to the court. The letter described the beatings that she had sustained and said that the whipping with the extension cord hurt the most. She ended that letter by writing in capital letters, "Help me, please." An elderly man lost a leg in an accident and needed medical treatment but was unable to get it because the two companies that insured him could not agree as to which one had the primary responsibility to pay the expenses. And the woman who came into court for an order for protection because she found her husband's journal that detailed the plans and preparations he was making to kill her and their children. These are just three of the hundreds of thousands of people that come to the court each year at critical times in their lives. That is why funding for the courts is so important. We have been responsible stewards of the money that you have provided in the past. Sue and the chief mentioned the technologies that we've been leveraging to be more efficient. That includes a centralized payable project that Sue talked about that has reduced our staff needs, that has provided more payment options for the people, that has increased the collections, and that has provided greater accountability. We are increasingly using interactive TV for interpreters, for hearings, for trainings, and for conferences to reduce the travel costs and to increase and enhance the access of people to the services of the court. I think Sue mentioned electronic filing that we have been piloting and pioneering, where the law enforcement, lawyers, and litigants can file documents electronically with the courts and also can have remote access to the court records, the calendars, the pleadings. In addition to those efficiency initiatives, we've also been trying to work on effectiveness. We want to do a better job for the people of the state of Minnesota. I think you're all aware of problem-solving courts. I think we have problem-solving courts in every district in the state. These are the courts that address the underlying mental health and chemical dependency issues that often drive criminal behavior and contribute to family dysfunction. Many of the counties in the state, after Hennepin's leadership, have started an E&E process for dissolution cases. That's a new approach that involves early court intervention, and it's been very promising to decrease the animosity and the bitterness of these proceedings. It has lessened the time needed for the people going through this difficult process to resolve their differences and has decreased the cost for everyone involved. We've also, because there are so many people now that are representing themselves in court, have, and again in Hennepin County taking the lead, established a process to help people who are going through representation of themselves in these serious matters. We have provided forms, brochures, online tutorials, and also assistance from lawyers who will talk to these people to help them through some of these difficult processes. We also have been doing a good job. The funding that you have provided us is well spent. Minnesota courts have a national reputation for excellence, innovation, fairness, and impartiality. We are consistently rated by the National Chamber of Commerce among the top 10 courts in the nation for timely service and impartial service. A 2005 public opinion poll found that 80% of the respondents expressed confidence in the courts. Now, there certainly are concerns. Reduced staff and resources have resulted in delays and in scheduling trials and other matters, and I think Senator Judge Neville will be talking about that. While I see him in this room, I naturally refer to him as Senator Neville. And you know that we don't have any control over our workload. We can't shut the doors of the court for a half a day or a day a week and reduce our caseloads by 20%. The cases don't go away. They just build up and add to the backlog that we're already experiencing. We have in the past used improved technology, better management, implementation of best practices, and the willingness of judges and court staff to accept more and more responsibility to absorb the cuts that have been taken in the past. Those measures to address funding reductions are very limited anymore because we have taken advantage of them to the extent that we can. I suggest to you that the funding for the courts should be a priority for the legislators. It should be a priority for Minnesota. It should be at least as important for the people of Minnesota as reduced class sizes and shorter commutes. The budget request that's been made by the judicial branch is to maintain the status quo so that the abused girl who needs a safe home, the elderly man that needs medical treatment, and the terrified woman who needs protection will not be turned away. The Constitution requires no less. The people of Minnesota deserve no less. And I truly believe that the legislature should fund no less. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Lynch. The next person to address the committee is Judge and former Senator Tom Neville.
Good afternoon. I apologize for being late. I actually had to work into the lunch hour, and then I had two snags on 35.
Now, so, Judge Neville, I was scratching my head whether a contempt charge by the Senate could fit into this. But, Linnea, could you look into that for me? Go ahead, Judge.
It wasn't intentional, and there is excusable neglect. So.
You know, when when then Senator Knutson and Judge Knutson was here, I told the committee I was waiting for this moment to get Judge Knutson before me, and I don't have that same feeling toward you. But
that's because our offices were right next to each other for so
that's
long.
Right.
Well, I have a handout that, and I. If I was a lawyer arguing a case, I would never read a final argument. But if it's okay with you, I have some prepared remarks, and I'll read them, and then I'm sure you'll have some questions later. My name is Tom Neville. I'm a judge in Faribault, Rice County in the 3rd Judicial District, which includes 11 counties in southeast Minnesota. I was also a member of the Minnesota Senate and a member of this committee for 17 years until 3 years ago, when I became a judge. And I am here to urge your support for the judicial branch request, which essentially is to maintain the 2011 funding levels. Judges in most judicial districts meet quarterly as a group. And ever since my first meeting in the 3rd District 3 years ago, budget issues have dominated our discussions. Like other state agencies in Minnesota, we in the judicial branch have absorbed budget cuts over the past 3 years through a combination of employee layoffs, unpaid leaves, elimination of our law clerks, closing courthouse windows and telephone lines for a half a day a week, and implementing technological and other efficiencies. And I work a lot of overtime. I work through lunch hours. I take work home. It's more work than when I was a private lawyer, I'll tell you that. Each county also has its own legal culture and has adapted in other ways. For example, in Rice County, where I am a judge, public defenders asked our court to indefinitely continue non-enhanceable misdemeanor cases until their staffing levels increased. Our three judges weren't willing to indefinitely continue misdemeanor cases, so we sent out a call to private lawyers in Rice County. 10 lawyers agreed to accept one or two cases a month to represent indigent defendants on a pro bono basis. They handle DUIs, domestic assaults, traffic theft, and other types of cases. And because of this, we have not, in Rice County at least, experienced the significant delays in resolving these cases. However, I don't know how long this program will be able to continue. other counties are experiencing greater delays. In Olmsted County, misdemeanor cases are now set out 10 months. Other civil trials are set out 15 months. In Steele County, Owatonna being the county seat, they're setting them out 7 months and 13 months, respectively. Throughout the judicial district, our court administration staff is working at 83% of their historical levels and need. Judges are staffed at 86% of need, and public defenders are staffed at 56% of need. I might note that in the third district, I think I saw some numbers that I know we're not going to get them this year, but the next three judges, new judges you approve, we get two of them in the third district. So that I think what that means is that, at least based on weighted caseload studies, we're handling more cases per judge than other districts around the state. The third district is 4.3 judges short of what is needed. We have less time to spend per case, and that affects justice and the appearance and perception of fairness. The lack of sufficient public defender resources is causing an exponential increase in inefficiency and collateral consequences throughout the justice system. Continuance requests occur regularly. When we continue a case, the file has to be touched by court staff more often. Notices and court minutes have to be prepared. Lawyers, law enforcement officers, guardians, social service people, probation officers, interpreters, and jury costs are all increased. Systemic inefficiencies decrease public trust and confidence in the courts when cases have to be set and reset multiple times. I have one case involving a criminal vehicular homicide that has been continued 11 times, mostly because the public defender hasn't been prepared to proceed. I often tell litigants they get 4 hours for their court trials when they ask for a day. I don't have as much time for hearings involving pro se litigants. This usually involves cases like divorce and domestic abuse order for protection hearings where people don't have lawyers of their own. The shortage of public defenders is especially challenging. We have three judges in three courtrooms in Rice County. Every week, our public defenders are scheduled in two courtrooms at once, causing judges, prosecutors, and others who have non-public defender cases to wait. Some defendants have actually told me that they were never interviewed by their public defender on the morning that their jury trial was set to begin. Public defenders tell me regularly that they need a continuance because they're not prepared to proceed with the hearing or the trial. They just have too many cases. So here's the summary of my message to you as legislators. And maybe this is partly personal opinion and partly a compilation of what I've heard from other judges in the third district. First, judges and court staff understand the state's budget problem. We enjoy our work and we're not expecting a raise for a while. Two, however, we cannot fairly and promptly resolve cases if the court budget is cut further over the next 2 years. Our cases are already being delayed too long. Three, we need more public defenders. We also need the legislature, frankly, to clarify which cases the public defender should be handling and which ones should get court-appointed lawyers paid by the county. I suspect you'll be facing that issue this year. Number four, don't create any new laws or mandates on courts that have fiscal costs since you don't have the extra money to give us to handle this. And we have enough just trying to handle what we do now. Ask judges during the course of this session to suggest statutory changes which will allow the courts to save money and operate more efficiently. Don't create more limitations on judicial discretion. Number five, the judicial branch will continue to implement technological and other efficiencies on our own. Improvements such as what Judge Lynch mentioned, the centralized payment center, electronic filing of criminal complaints, expansion of the use of interactive television, and there's the beginning right now of filing civil documents electronically as well, have already allowed the courts to use its time more efficiently, and I suspect that we'll be collecting our fee revenue to a greater level as well. And finally, even though maybe what I said sounds like it, I'm really not here to complain. These are challenging times. The legislature has a tough job this year. I think that the judicial branch can keep its head above water if you don't cut our budget levels further and if you give us more public defenders. However, I caution that further budget cuts will have consequences, primarily in case delays. The legislature creates the laws, but the courts apply them to real people and situations. This is our constitutional duty. We don't control the volume of cases which come before us, and fairness requires adequate time for judges to hear people and understand their claims when they come before us. Remember, the justice delayed is often justice denied. So thank you. Those are my remarks.
Thank you, Judge Neville. Judge, that doesn't surprise me that you work long hours, because you and I shared or were neighboring offices for many years over in the state office building. And I often would be late, working late, but you were working later, and it was on a constant basis. And it doesn't surprise me at all that you bring that same devotion to service as you do being a judge, as you did as a senator.
It's the other judges, too. They're working
hard. I'm sure of that. Are there any questions for Senator Judge Neville? Yes, Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at your number four issue here on your suggestions. And by the way, that's great that you have some suggestions here. I think we're going to need a lot of those this session. But the mandates or laws, do you have a list of mandates that you would like to see gone that would help help you resolve some of these budget issues?
I'll give you one.
Okay.
That's caused a lot of confusion and probably different ways of applying it, and that's domestic abuse, DANCOs. Domestic abuse, no contact orders. We have orders for protection. We have harassment restraining orders. I'm speaking on my own behalf right now. I don't think that the judicial council or there's a legislative advisory work group. I don't think this is one of their formal positions. But last session, you said that if we're going to have domestic abuse, no contact orders, first we issue conditions of release to the criminal defendant, and then we hold a separate proceeding after that to decide whether we also issue a DANCO, which is a no-contact order, if a person's charged with domestic abuse. You didn't give us much guideline. We don't know what kind of due process we have to give. It's not a confidential hearing. So unlike an order for protection hearing, where if the defendant wants to respond or testify or cross-examine, it's privileged in that context. In whatever this supplemental proceeding is for a DANCO, it doesn't appear to be privileged. So most people don't really tend to respond. Different counties have responded different ways. Some people allow the defendant to testify. For a while in Rice County, we weren't issuing DANCOs. We were issuing ex parte OFPs instead, which then allowed the person to request a hearing and go into that proceeding, which is a civil proceeding, to reply. And if they wanted to contest the no-contact order. A lot of times we issue them when the victims weren't asking for them. So that's the type of thing. You created a new separate proceeding for us. You didn't give us much guidelines. I think there was some confusion initially in trying to figure out how to implement that.
Mr. Chair and Senator Goodman, if I might, the Judicial Chief Council Gilder does have a what I will call a policy bill that will be coming later that has a number of suggestions, shall we say, that we'll be talking with you about on a different day.
Mr. Chair, just a quick follow-up. I talked about this in Finance Committee this morning, but I think in light of this huge budget shortfall we have, that in the Finance Committees and in the main Finance Committee, we should ask people that come before us to give us two pieces of information. One is how many jobs will be created or lost under different scenarios that we present to once the finance bill comes around. And the other is what the cost of the mandates will be, that are any new mandates that are included in bills. I think the only way we're going to get a handle on what we're doing is to kind of sum up how many jobs will be lost or gained in different committees and what the mandates are going to cost, just not only the court system, but perhaps the county courts as well. So that's my suggestion.
Thank you, Senator Goodwin. You make a good point that sometimes in the sterile environment of a committee, as we're making policies, and especially around the areas of budgets, we think we're doing the right thing, but it probably would behoove us, all of us, and compliment the public of just what are these decisions really going to do to agencies and departments and the level of service we give our citizens. Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Judge Neville, it's a pleasure to have you back here. You've been missed, and for me, you are a great role model in so much of what I do. And so thank you for coming. Your words always have great impact with me. I wanted to ask you all, really, and make a comment that I've made before. There have been occasions when legislators have sought input, and it is very difficult to get input from the Judges Association or official positions or even unofficial positions. I think the only way I've been able to do it really has been to ask someone on the bench, well, what do you think? But for instance, Senator Letts and I both have worked very hard on an expungement process that we think would help in the state of Minnesota in so many different ways. But it's very hard to get the input to help us get that right. And we seek the input, but it's very hard to get an official position in support, even though I think that there are many judges that would support legislation like that. And so I'm wondering if you can't go back to the Judges Association or the State Court Association or the Council to say, how can you help us more with trying to accomplish our goals? Can you help us make sure we get it right when we pass these laws, that if we're going to do the domestic abuse no contact orders, that we get it right so that it's a useful set of statutory provisions for you and that we haven't missed something or there isn't a mandate that we didn't foresee? And there's got to be a way that we can have better dialogue about that before it becomes law that you have to live with. I'm wondering if you can't look internally at that. I understand you have recommendations about the budget, but maybe that could go a little further.
There's a policy that, is it the Judicial Council or the Supreme Court, has passed. And, I mean, I think the general, I'm going to paraphrase it, but individual judges, as long as they don't speak for the judiciary, can work with the legislature. But historically, the court hasn't taken positions on policy things unless they somehow directly impact on the operations of the court. There was a slight change to that policy this year again, I'm paraphrasing. I don't have it right in front of me. But it allows the courts now to comment not only on things that will cost money, but also things that will save money. I don't know if maybe the Chief or Judge Lynch want to comment on their interpretation of that, but whether or not, to take your example, that would allow the courts to comment on how it would procedurally impact us in terms of the burden on judges.
If you have a brief comment,
Mr. Chair, hear it.
But we do have a lengthy agenda still.
I think one of the concerns that most judges would have is to comment on the validity of some process and then have it before them challenging the validity of that process. So I think there's a fine line that we try to walk to make sure that we don't get into a position where we are endorsing something that we may have to rule on in the future. I think that there is some possibilities and opportunities to have a better dialogue and discussion on many of these things, and I think that would be good for both branches.
Thank you, Judge. The next,
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Marty.
One more thing while we've got three judges there. Mm-hmm. I don't want to, you don't have to respond to this, but there are lots of areas of the state budget where there might be problems and where the state's not adequately funding something. Yours is a constitutionally guaranteed one, and because you're a separate branch of government, I think this has happened. I mean, I think federal courts over 20, 30 years ago at times were stepping in and saying legislature was not or Congress was not funding something that needed to be funded for constitutional reasons. And obviously the court, if the court feels the judiciary is not able to do its constitutional obligation, it has some power too. Public defenders or prosecutors or somebody going to the courts and saying, look, we can't provide a fair trial, which is constitutionally guaranteed, and the courts can step in. You may not want to comment on that, and I don't want to provoke anything because I think we want to work together as different branches of government. But just wondered, what are there options like that? Is that something the courts have ever talked about? Because when we're talking about defendants being released because or even a convicted one released because of his lack of a speedy trial, is there ever a point where the courts step in and say, look, it's our constitutional requirement to do this? You don't have to answer if you don't want. I'm not trying to push it. But this was curious.
Senator Marty.
Chief Gilday.
Thank you for the question. And we look very much forward to working cooperatively with the legislature so that we can avoid that kind of confrontation.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I hope so as well. I just was curious.
Thank you. The committee is running away with my agenda. And if you could hold your questions for later, if we have time, I have to move to Chief Judge Matthew Johnson from the Court of Appeals. Welcome, Judge.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Matt Johnson. I'm the Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals. I have been in that position since November of 2010 when I succeeded former Chief Judge Edward Toussaint, whom I think many of you know well. All of us on the court were very sad when Judge Toussaint decided to step down from his chief judge duties, but he remains an active member of the court. I was here Tuesday morning, and I heard all of you introduce yourselves, and I appreciate that. I look forward to getting to know you. Along those lines, I want to just briefly introduce myself. I grew up in small towns in southern Minnesota and northern Iowa. I attended St. Olaf College. I got my degree in economics, which is by definition the study of the allocation of scarce resources. I think that training serves me well in this role. After a few years in the workforce, I went to William Mitchell College of Law in St. Paul, practiced law in downtown Minneapolis until I joined the court in 2008. I live in St. Paul in the Merriam Park neighborhood, District 64, with my wife and three kids. During my allotted time here today, I want to make three main points. The first is that the Court of Appeals serves a critical role in the judicial branch and thus in state government. Two, that the Court of Appeals is a very lean, efficient, smooth-functioning court. And three, that the Court of Appeals is very vulnerable to reductions in its budget, which would have dire consequences. I think a little bit of history is appropriate for the first point. The Court of Appeals is only 27 years old. Before the Court of Appeals existed, the Supreme Court was overloaded with appeals from the district courts. There were far more appeals to the Supreme Court than the Supreme Court could decide, as a Supreme Court typically does. Most litigants did not get an oral argument before the Supreme Court. In most appeals, the court decided the case with a very short one-sentence, one-paragraph opinion, which did not discuss the merits of the case. This situation was deemed intolerable because of two fundamental principles of the judicial process. First is a meaningful opportunity to be heard. The second principle is a statement of the court's reasons for its decision. So this situation in the late 70s and early 80s led to a movement, which was led in many ways by then Chief Justice Douglas Omdahl, to amend the Constitution to create the Court of Appeals. In 1982, the legislature and the people approved that amendment, and our court began hearing cases in 1983. And now, in every case, a party with a lawyer has a right, if the party wishes, to oral argument, and all of our opinions are issued with a statement of the law and the facts of the case and of the reasons for the decision. And that is important even in cases that are not appealed, because in the many cases that are not appealed, you want the district judge to know that there is a ready means available to correct any errors of law that occur, and you want the parties to know that they have a ready means of correcting legal error. Second, this Court of Appeals is very efficient, and I say this for two reasons. First, we have wise, well-developed processes in place. Second, our people work very hard. Just as Judge Neville described, the judges of our court routinely work evenings and weekends. The job simply cannot be done in a 40-hour work week, and I'm very proud of the hard work that's done both by our judges and our staff. If I had more time, I could demonstrate for you how efficient we are in comparison with other intermediate appellate courts. I know that Senator Jungbauer likes numbers. I like numbers, too, and I have numbers available. I know not everybody likes numbers, so I'll save them for later. But in terms of opinions issued by per judge, in terms of number of law clerks per judge, in terms of number of cases handled by each law clerk per year, in terms of the number of staff attorneys per case, our court compares very favorably to other intermediate appellate courts in the state and federal system, and I'm prepared to discuss that later. By all of those measures, we are a very efficient court. Your constituents' tax dollars are very well spent at our court. I also want to assure you that we are continually trying to find ways to fulfill our mission more efficiently. I'll mention one. We recently adopted a new family law mediation program. We had a pilot project for the last 2.5 years that was very successful. More than half the cases settled. That allowed us to resolve those cases at about 1/5 the cost of a typical appeal. With the Supreme Court's approval, that is now a permanent program. Third, we're very sensitive to budget cuts. 87% of our budget is people, human resources, and of all of our people, 78% of our people are legally trained, lawyers, law clerks, staff attorneys, people who are involved in advisory or decision-making positions. We have a very modest number of administrative assistants, and we have only two other positions on an FTE basis in the court. One is to schedule cases, which is essential. One is a receptionist, and the other is somebody to run the mediation program, which saves us money. We do not have a professional administrator. All of the managerial and operational tasks are shared by judges, staff attorneys, law clerks, and administrative assistants. Since I joined the court three years ago, we have had to reduce the number of law clerks by 15%. And we had to do this because of very small budget cuts in fiscal year 10 and 11, cuts of 1.8% and 1.1%. Those cuts seem small, but their effect is magnified because our fixed cost and our essential costs leave us with very few options. If our budget were cut further, I think that the situation would become very unfortunate. We cannot continue to do our cases at the same quantity or at the same quality if our budget is cut further. We would either have a backlog that would quickly develop, or we might be back in the situation we were in 30 years ago where litigants do not get oral argument and do not get a statement of reasons for their opinion. I do not want to see our court go in that direction, and from a personal standpoint, I would be very regretful if I were the chief judge when that happened. Please keep in mind that our budget request for the next biennium is less than $10.2 million per year. Mr. Chairman, I know that you and the committee have some very difficult decisions to make, and my goal is to just make you fully informed about the Court of Appeals as you allocate scarce resources. Thank you for this opportunity, and I look forward to talking further.
Thank you, Judge. We have the Board of Public Defense. We've reserved them 25 minutes, and we're now down to about 18 minutes left in our day. We do have some time that we could extend for a few minutes after the allotted time, so I think we're going to forego questions for now. The gentleman from the Board of Public Defense should approach the table. And sorry for the shorter time, but I'm sure you can be concise and clear. And who would choose to go first?
Mr. Chairman and members, for the record, my name is Kevin Kyer. I'm the Chief Administrator for the Board of Public Defense. With me today is Bill Ward. He is the Chief Public Defender in the 4th Judicial District, Hennepin County, and also served as the Chief Public Defender in the 10th Judicial District. Those counties kind of in the arc around the northeast to the northwest of the Twin Cities, so he has a unique perspective on both kind of practicing in an urban area, but also in a somewhat rural and actually suburban area. We're going to cut this down, Mr. Chairman, because I think you heard some of the comments from the court that really are echoed in what we do, and I think Judge Neville was particularly accurate in his assessment of what's going on. But the Board of Public Defense is a judicial branch agency. We provide trial and appellate-level criminal defense services that are mandated by Constitution or statute. That's all that we do. We have 10 judicial district public defender offices around the state, 18 satellite offices around the state, and an appellate office with 28 lawyers in it that handle all of the criminal appeals, post-conviction remedies, the supervised release, what we used to call parole revocation hearings, and also the end of confinement review appeals in sex offender cases. We also fund, through a legislative appropriation, four public defense corporations. These go back to the 1960s, actually, and they provide criminal defense services for the minority communities. They are the Legal Rights Center in Minneapolis, the Neighborhood Justice Center in St. Paul, the Duluth Indian Legal Corporation, and also the Regional Native Public Defense Corporation that serves White Earth and Leech Lake. On the district level, we have approximately 360 full-time equivalent attorneys. They handle roughly 160,000 cases a year. Roughly about 400 cases, or a little over 400 cases a year. The last piece of information that I saw from Wisconsin, they had about, their public defenders are handling about 300 cases a year. And I think, as Judge Neville indicated and some of the others, is you've heard some of the stories about the difficulty that we're having keeping up. I think one important component of this is about half of our staff is part-time. They are the backbone of what we do in the greater Minnesota area. They handle all conflict cases. They handle whatever cases come around and whatever they're assigned to, and they do it for a set amount of money. They provide their own overhead. We provide them a small stipend for overhead. But generally, they're paying for their own secretary, they're paying for their own rent, they're paying for their own heat and lights. They are really kind of the backbone of what we do, and that is a critical, critical piece that we are really seeing starting to fray. On the budget side, we have a budget of about $67 million for this year. About 1.9 of it comes from an attorney registration fee of $75 that the Supreme Court approved 2 years ago. Roughly $600,000 in federal funding. Both of those funding flows are scheduled to end on June 30th of this year. So a status quo budget really puts us about $2.5 million short of where we are right now. That's roughly 43 full-time equivalent lawyers in our system. So you got 43 minus or subtracted from the 360. For those of you that don't know, and some of you who have been around here a little bit, we handle about 85 to 90% of all serious cases that come through the court system, about 90% of the juvenile cases. Public defenders cannot refuse cases. We, again, as the court, whatever comes in the door, we have to take. In that handout that you have, some of the factors that we've identified that kind of influence that workload. And I'm not going to go through all of those, but I just want to highlight a couple of them. Over the last several years, I guess it was 1987 to 2005, the legislature enacted 86 sentencing enhancements during that time period. Those are all issues that come before us. From 1998 to 2008, 26 new judgeships were created, sorely needed. I'm not here to say that they aren't, because the court is down another 20 judges. But each of those comes with a calendar. Each of those comes with somewhere where we have to be. And I think, again, Judge Neville said it best, we're trying to cover too many places at the same time. Supreme Court decisions. A number of years ago, and I think a couple of you were co-authors of that bill, to give us some discretion in our appellate office to refuse some appeals. A state court decided that wasn't appropriate, that was unconstitutional. So we don't have that discretion. Police, we had a sting operation up in Roseau about 2 years ago. We had 35 co-defendants in that sting operation. The nearest lawyer we have to Roseau, Minnesota is 70 miles away. That's the nearest one, let alone coming, getting lawyers for 35 people. Another one, and Mr. Ward may be able to touch on this because I think they're in the throes of it, is federal funding for DNA analysis, cold hit cases. Again, a good thing, the technology is there. Those are extremely difficult cases for us because we don't have the resources to do that analysis. The sheriff's office in Hennepin County got a $500,000 grant to put a unit together to do those cold hit cases. Again, I'm not here to argue that they shouldn't have. Our entire budget on the state level for all expert witnesses is $120,000. So we really have to be judicious in terms of that use. We do face some significant challenges over the next couple of years. As I said, we are down 63 lawyers from where we were in 2008. It's about 15% of our staff. That's 120,000 hours of attorney time. Part-time defenders, on average, put in about 40,000 extra hours a year that they don't get paid for. That's the way the system continues to operate, particularly in greater Minnesota. For the lawyers in the room, I want to, and those that are practicing, I know that Senator Latz does, I know Senator Thompson that you do, is here's really kind of what the crux of it is. Imagine that you have a client that comes in. In fact, he doesn't even come into the office. And you can't even meet with them until you tell them you can't meet with them until the day of your court appearance. Then when you meet with them, you have 10 minutes to explain to them what the charge is, what the consequences are for the various outcomes that you may have. Evaluate the case, explain to them, and then sit down and get a decision from that client. That's really what we're dealing with here, and that's from the legislative auditor's report. And oh, by the way, if you are in certain counties in this state, I'm not going to show up to your first appearance, whether you're in custody or out of custody. We have about half the counties in the state where we are not there for first appearance. We just don't have the people to do it, and I know that Bill's had that experience up in the 10th Judicial District. In exchange for this, we're going to give you $35 an hour because that's what the average salary is for our defenders right now. That's gross. If you're a part-timer, you're taking your overhead and everything else out of that amount of money. The impacts on the judicial system, Mr. Chairman, they're in the handout. I'm going to skip through those because I think you've heard a lot of those already. We have been a good steward of public funds. About 98%, 97.5% of our budget is direct service to clients. 90% of the budget is personnel. We don't do anything other than mandated services. We've implemented a number of the cost-saving measures. They're outlined in that handout as well. I would like to visit with a couple of you in regard to some of the things that we've talked about, particularly ITV and electronic disclosure, because there are some issues relative to where that workload ends up falling, but I'm not going to take the time to deal with that today. In our budget request, it is a rather large one, and I'm not going to fool you in any way to say it's not. And it starts on page 32. We are asking for the funding to fund those 63 lawyer positions to get those back. We are asking for anticipated personnel costs over the next biennium. Our folks did take a hard freeze in salary the last 2 years, just as we did in the courts. We have to do something to improve on that $35 an hour figure. We're trying to also, we have in there an issue on mandated costs. I think it's on page 35 in that handout. The first one is appellate office transcripts. Our budget is at $300,000 a year for appellate office transcripts. On average, over the last 8 years, we've expended about $675,000. Those of you who have been around here, I know, Mr. Chairman, you've dealt with this issue. Senator Latz, I think you've dealt with this issue on occasion, is we basically hold the bills. And we're holding them right now, or we will start next week. We're going to not pay those bills until we get a new appropriation July 1st. And it just keeps rolling like that. Sometimes we catch up. Sometimes we don't. Expert witness fees. As I said, we have about $120,000 in the budget right now. That amount has not changed over the last several years. As we get more of these cases with DNA analysis, as we get more cases with ballistics and other forensic sciences, we just do not have the ability to match the resources that the prosecution has. either through the BCA, the FBI, the various sheriff offices that have those facilities available to them. A third portion of that is a Supreme Court decision in a case called Padilla, where lawyers are now responsible for providing information to folks on immigration consequences of their criminal conviction. And it really is not an immigration issue. What it is an issue of what those lawyers are now responsible for. This is a whole new area of law that our folks have never dealt with. It's a very complicated area of law, and they are now responsible for that. And frankly, their attorney license is now in jeopardy or potentially in jeopardy for not being able to provide that information. So we're asking for some small amount of money to be able to deal with those issues. Finally, Mr. Chairman, as I mentioned, we have four public defense corporations that provide services. They handle about 4,000 cases a year that but for those corporations would be public defender cases. There's a modest increase to be asked for there. I think it's $100,000 or $101,000 to keep those corporations solvent so those cases aren't falling back on the public defender system. I am happy to talk more about any of those. I know you're running short of time, and I know that Mr. Ward would like to kind of follow up on some of this. So that's the very quick and dirty version of it.
Thank you, Mr. Kyer. In light of the time, I'm going to opt to extend our time till 2:40 in this room. And if members have to go somewhere, they're welcome to leave. But nevertheless, I hope that most of us stick around and listen to Mr. Ward. And if there's any time for questions, we can reserve that. Mr. Ward.
Mr.
Welcome
Chair.
To the committee.
Again, my name is William Ward. I am the Chief Public Defender of Hennepin County, which is the 4th Judicial District, and I will be quick. My perspective is a little bit different. I have been a lawyer for 24 years, 10 years in Minnesota, and 14 years in Illinois and Cook County. And what I watched happen in Cook County during my tenure there in the Public Defender's Office, I'm watching the same thing here happen in Minnesota. I came to Minnesota because of the system that was established here in the 90s, the ability to have equal access to the courts by those in need, no matter what place you were arrested in, no matter what county you were presented to in court. I was very proud of coming here to work with a state system where technology was transferred across 87 counties, the training was across 87 counties, and the same expertise was across all 87 counties. There are a lot of things to be proud of here, there's no doubt. The fact that we have scales, recording of statements in custody, the discovery process where the prosecution gives us almost an open book of what the case entails. But there's a lot of things that those of you who are lawyers know we should really be embarrassed about. And some of those Kevin mentioned. The fact that in this state, over half the counties do not have lawyers representing indigent accused at the first appearance is abhorrent. It's a constitutionally mandated appearance, yet we don't have the facility and the bodies to send lawyers there. We are putting the onus on the bench to represent these folks, basically, and to tell them what the charges are and ask them questions without having counsel there. That's embarrassing. We should be embarrassed by the fact that these speedy trials issues are coming up, but let's talk about what the reality is. If our office, even on a 10th or 15% of the cases, demanded speeding trials, the court system would come to a screeching halt. The reality is that we don't demand cases on all those, we don't demand speedies on all those cases because we don't have the ability to be prepared. We are asking for those continuances. We are pushing those cases out. We are the reason that the court system is incurring more costs. We're the reason the jails are incurring the costs. And we're the reasons our clients' liberties are being violated because they're in custody for longer periods of time. That's something we should be embarrassed about. We should be embarrassed by the fact that our lawyers have to ask for continuances to be prepared. We should be embarrassed by the fact that we haven't talked to the clients for more than 5 to 10 minutes at times before seeing them in court. We should be embarrassed by the fact that we talk to them after the court appearance and not before. And I ask those of you who are lawyers in private practice, have you ever been forced to set more than one or two matters for trial on any given trial calendar? You haven't. Whether it be in civil and criminal, it doesn't happen. In Pine County and Isani County, where I was the chief in the 10th, There are routinely 50 to 60 cases set for the trial calendar, and there's two lawyers handling those cases. That's the system that we have in place now. It's more than a cattle call. If you go to Minneapolis to the public safety facility, it's throngs of people who are asking to talk to their lawyers. Those lawyers are double and triple booked in other courtrooms, even though they're supposed to be in the arraignment calendar, because they have sentencing elsewhere. That's the type of system we are now operating in. When I say I worked in Cook County and why I'm afraid we're going in that direction, I will tell you something that's also embarrassing. I had a client who was charged with murder, and by the time we resolved this case, he was in custody in the Cook County Jail, 10 days shy of 5 years awaiting resolution of his case. It took us that long to be able to resolve that case. It took that long to work up the mitigation, and it took that long for us to be prepared for the resolution. He was in custody the entire 5-year duration. When we talk about what's happening, the other thing that we should be proud of originally is that the rules we set up here and how fast cases go through the system. We can't keep up with the quick pace of those cases. That's why the courts keep talking about the delay. That's why we keep talking about the speedy trial issues. The way it's set up now and the way those demands are being made, it's impossible for my staff to meet those demands. Every day, myself and Bob Sorensen, who's also a manager in my office, we field calls from clients because their lawyers haven't talked to them. We field calls from them because their cases were continued because we weren't prepared. And I have to tell them honestly, they want their lawyers to be prepared, and they have to work on one case after another to get to that level. When you have crushing caseloads, which we do in every single county in this state, it takes the time that we need to take to get there. But the big animal in the room, the elephant in the room, is I think everybody needs to be reminded of this. Our ethical responsibilities are exactly the same as someone from Dorsey Whitney all the way down to legal aid. We have the same responsibilities to our client to do the ethical and represent them ethically and zealously to the best of our ability. And I'm embarrassed to tell you, we're failing there as well. There aren't a whole lot of lawyers who want to admit that because they're afraid of their license, obviously. But even as recently as a month ago in the Minnesota Post online, they asked anonymously of these lawyers, have you not met your ethical responsibilities? And 60% of the lawyers in our state in the public defense arena said yes. That's what's going on in the system. My last point, and Mr. Kier referred to it, is Padilla. Yes, we have a responsibility to our citizens, and yes, Padilla is not about immigration as much. But what the Supreme Court has hoisted on us is something unfathomable as to the amount of knowledge it takes, so we are not damaging or in some way harming our clients. And the information that we have to obtain to do what we are now told we have to do by the Supreme Court is beyond my grasp. And we, as an office, have too failed in this for decades. We are in the process. We have volunteer help. We've contracted with somebody to help us. But it is so far beyond our grasp, but we are not prepared to meet the challenge, again, that the U.S. Supreme Court put on us. With that, I'll conclude my remarks.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Ward. Mr. Ward, I had a question. Not being an attorney, maybe you can help me understand this. If we had a Cook County example where we held someone in a jail awaiting trial for over 4 years, and if for some reason there wasn't enough evidence, or the case was thrown out, or in the case an individual was found not guilty, what are the consequences to the state if a citizen is held that long? Do they have a right to sue the state? Is there a legal framework there for any type of consequence?
In Minnesota, my understanding is that there's immunity for all of us, which is interesting in and of itself, that public defenders are immune from lawsuit if they acted in their duties as representatives of the agency. No, the consequences is to the individual who has been in custody away from his or her family for that period of time. There are consequences for wrongful convictions, purposeful convictions, but I'm not even talking about that very, very far example. I'm just talking about your average case of delay.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chairman.
Sorry to cut you off before.
That's all right. I understand. I believe I would direct this to both of you. When I looked at the numbers that Senator Neville provided, that we're only staffing the public defender at 56% of capacity, it seems to be way below where we're staffing the other areas. I know that much of the qualification for a public defender is constitutionally mandated. It's a constitutional issue. But I can't help but wonder when I see that, is the standard for providing public defender assistance in Minnesota, do we have a much higher standard than the constitutional mandate that is somewhat putting pressure on you because we're serving a higher percentage of our criminal defendants than would be going on in other states?
Mr. Chairman, let me try to address that. I don't know, maybe Bill has some answers. Is we have struggled with the issue of eligibility for as long as I've been doing this, which is 20 years doing this and 5 years behind that table. Essentially, when you see that 85 to 90% number, that's across the country. I mean, no matter what eligibility standard they have. In Minnesota, we have a legislative auditor found last year that there are some tweaks that you can make to it, but there's always the out, and needs to be the out, of the judges being able to go beyond that if they need to, in light of someone not being able to afford an attorney. Remember, the standard is not necessarily what that income level is, but whether or not you can afford an attorney. The last time I went and needed an attorney, which was a couple of years ago, I got charged $175 an hour. I thought that was a bargain. So it's a difficult question. In Wisconsin, for example, they just raised the income level. The income threshold, I think, at one time was $8,000 a year. The difference between Minnesota and Wisconsin is if you don't qualify for the state public defender, you can then go to appointed counsel system that's paid for by the counties at $50 an hour, or whatever the rate is. So there was a backup system, which didn't save anybody any money, just shifted the burden. So.
Mr. Chair, if I can also answer, in Hennepin County, it really isn't an issue. I mean, these are truly indigent individuals. And this issue's come up over the years, and Mr. Kyer, Mr. Stewart has directed all of the chiefs to talk to all of the judges about this. And we have. We've had brown bag lunches and explaining to them that who is eligible and what standards should be used. And I think the courts have actually done a very good job. We all hear about those cases where we don't think the person should have gotten a lawyer. Believe me, my lawyers call me if they think the person shouldn't have gotten a lawyer, call Mr. Sorensen, and we deal with it. I think those are cases that we hear about because we feel it's an egregious appointment. I do take responsibility and deal with the issue with the court. I know the other chiefs do as well. So if it happens, it's something that we do address.
Thank you. Mr. Kyer, does your organization or department offer ride-along programs for legislators to follow a typical work day of a public defender?
Mr. Chairman, absolutely. We've had a number of folks who have taken advantage of that. We got the law enforcement centers a mile away from the Capitol, Ramsey County, and we are more than happy to have folks tag along for an hour, half a day, full day, whatever. I know that Mr. Ward's office has done it on a number of occasions. I think, frankly, they scared the legislative auditor staff.
Yeah, they're very tired.
When they went there, one of which retired right after that, I think. So, but we are more than happy to do that.
Thank you. Any other questions? Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, a couple of thoughts. One is in direct response to the senator's comment. I provide some free legal services in Hennepin County on what's called the Misdemeanor Defense Panel. Basically the misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor calendars in the mornings and in downtown Minneapolis now in the afternoons for the traffic calendar. When I go to downtown Minneapolis, first thing I do is I look on the list of those who have checked in and applied for the public defender's office for help. They divide out those who are in custody, not in custody, and those who are eligible and not eligible for the public defender's office. And frankly, it's rare that I see someone in the not eligible for public defender's category. Just about everyone who's on those calendars qualifies for the public defender. Now, I give free advice to those who are not eligible.
And we appreciate that.
thank you. There's a 90% or plus of the cases, certainly in downtown Minneapolis, are qualified for their constitutional representation. On another point, I know of one public defender in one of the suburban offices in Hennepin County that is actually just retired in December. And the reason he told me, confidentially, I won't reveal any sources, he felt he could not constitutionally continue his responsibilities. And so he retired. He didn't feel he was doing the job that was mandated by the Constitution any longer. And he'd been a PD for 20 years or so longer. I think the numbers are, at least in Hennepin County, the public defenders are handling about twice the caseload recommended by the American Bar Association. Twice the caseload. And $35 an hour, if that's the average that's paid, that's not enough to cover any overhead, let alone provide any income for anyone. Certainly not within the legal community. And I want to give two very short indications of liability that the state could face. I was chair of the Claims Committee last session, and we had a case came in which we resolved with a claim before us, but it was a person who had a case before the judicial system, and he had been sentenced incorrectly. There had been a clerical error, as it was described, and either by the judge or by the judge's clerk, as to the criminal history score. And as a result of that error, the person got sentenced to 5 years instead of what should have been about a 9 or 10 month sentence. The case was appealed. If it hadn't been appealed, this never would have been caught. But the public defender in the case in the district court didn't catch the error. The prosecutor didn't catch the error, and the judge didn't catch the error at the time. It was not caught in the appellate process until after the appellate process was well down the road. So twice in the public defender's office, this clerical error was missed. It eventually was caught. The appellate prosecutor didn't catch it, agreed once it was found. Eventually it was found by the public defender's office. And then the Court of Appeals, fortunately it was there and was able to dispose of the case properly. It was appealed on other grounds, by the way. But when it was caught, the person was released. And then by the time, or he was ordered to be released, it took another 3 weeks for him actually to be released because of delays within the correctional system. So we faced some real questions in the Claims Committee because the person who had been wrongfully incarcerated for about 8 months longer than he should have been came to us looking for a remedy. And we resolved the matter, and there is no statute in Minnesota dealing with it, and something we talked about in the Claims Committee coming up with, to deal with clerical errors or those kinds of errors, not questions of law where there's a change in judicial opinion. But you end up with exactly the same question you yourself brought up, Mr. Chairman. If someone, after 5 years in custody, ends up having a trial and being acquitted, what then? And is there some remedy? Let alone the questions of those who were wrongfully convicted with DNA evidence and get acquitted or their convictions thrown out down the road. So these are very real resource questions, and it's our jurisdiction to sort those out.
Thank you, Senator Latz. Senator Hall, you have the last question.
It's not a question, but in 15 seconds, I just want to say thank you for what you gentlemen do. I have a son that's a public defender for the last 5 years, and you guys sacrifice more than anybody I know, and so we really appreciate all that you do for us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Hall. Members, if you get a chance to look over this packet of clippings of what the court system is enduring over recent years and recent cuts, you may have a better understanding of not only their job but also some of the difficulties that recent budget decisions have put them under. There is no other business before the Senate Judiciary Committee. I've been told that I have to inform the at least the record that this proceeding was done on January 14th? 13th. And there is no other business, the Senate committee is adjourned.